I'm Kapka Kasabova, and it's my pleasure to welcome New Zealanders Graham Lay and Lloyd Spencer Davis and American guest Thomas Constam. We'll be talking about the agonies and ecstasies of travelling and writing about travelling. We have three vastly different books on travel here, but what they have in common is the sheer charm of their narrators and the quirky vision and, in turns, disturbing or exciting insights at the heart of their stories. What's going to happen is I'll have a quick talk to each writer about the book, and then we'll have a discussion, and then, of course, it'll be over to you for questions. Graham Lay is an Aucklander and wears many literary hats. He's a novelist, short story writer, anthologist, and travel writer. Today he's here as a travel writer, of course. Graham Lay is an expert on the Pacific Islands, and one of his most entertaining books to date, in my view, is the story collection, The Miss Tutti Frutti Competition. Today, however, we're talking about his latest and equally entertaining and enlightening book, Inside the Cannibal Pot. Rather than a single journey, it's a kind of compendium of a lifetime's travel, and each chapter is about a particular mode of travelling. Graham, just take us back in time to how and when your fascination with travel began.
Well, there's a chapter in the book called The Boy Traveller, Kapka, and it refers to my upbringing in a very small town in western Taranaki. And there wasn't a lot to do there, particularly in the wintertime, so I used to haunt the town library. I was very, very keen on reading. And when I was about 15, I came across a book, a hardback book, written by a man called Colin Simpson, an Australian who I imagine is long dead now. It was the first travel book I read, and it was lavishly illustrated, and it was an account of the author's journey from Iberia, from Portugal, right through into Scandinavia. And I was captivated by this book. It was wonderful. It had terrific descriptions of ancient villages and cobbled streets and castles, things that were conspicuously lacking in Opanaki. And about three-quarters of the way through the book, I also had another shaft of light went into my consciousness. This man not only writes about interesting places, but he gets paid to write about interesting places. And then, as a callow youth, I had sort of an ambition to be a travel writer from that time on. It took me 30 years to get there, but eventually I did it. But it was that one book, I remember very clearly, that sparked off the ambition to become a travel writer.
You say in the book, in the introduction to the book, that the travel writer is like a home handyman who carefully saves every screw, nut, bolt and washer he finds, knowing that one day they will be put to some good use. Now, how did the book come about?
When you're travelling, and I'm sure that Lloyd and Thomas do the same thing, you take a notebook with you. So you write down all your impressions, and you know that some stage in the future those notes are going to come in useful. And so I put them all in a drawer, and occasionally the nuts and bolts come together as a magazine article or a story for a newspaper or something. But for this book, Inside the Cannibal Pot, it was actually suggested to me by somebody else. In this case, it was a very respected and experienced editor who said to me, "Why don't you write a book about travel?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, not a book about destinations, but about the whole idea of travel." It just so happened that I was going on a trip the next week, and I was sitting waiting for the airport bus in Key Street. And I looked around me, and there were buses and taxis and tour buses. People were getting on and off out of these vehicles. They were lugging suitcases and backpacks, and none of them looked very happy. I thought, this is the travel industry. Maybe, you know, why are these people doing this, you know? What motivates them to leave their home and their comfortable houses and go on risky trips or to often dangerous places? And so while I was away on that trip, I started to make some notes. And it seemed to me that there was a book in it, as indeed it turned out there was, but it wasn't the kind of book, you know, that I had written before. It was a different kind of travel book. And it was structured, as you say, according to the boy traveller, me growing up, and then travel writing as a genre has always interested me, so there was a chapter on that as well. I'd been on a cruise ship. I'd never done that before. That was a whole new aspect of the travel industry, which I was totally unaware of before I did that. So it all came together in that way, but it was a slightly unusual beginning to a book, if I can put it that way. Yeah.
What's also unusual about the book is that it kind of starts off in a slightly cynical vein. You describe the long, tedious waits at airports that we're all familiar with, and you describe modern travel as being overcrowded, but always with the capacity to surprise and occasionally to delight. So you start off sort of cynical and then actually take us on some quite wonderful journeys.
Yes, that's true. In spite of all that, and that discomfort and the expense and all that stuff, as a fiction writer, I always find material for short stories or novels while I'm away. It's that serendipity, the chance encounter or the interesting experience. You never know it's coming, but it almost always does arrive. And you can use it in other ways when you get home. I came across this wonderful expression. In America, they have whole academics who spend their whole lives writing about travel, the theory of travel. You know, this is an amazing thing to me. And I came across the expression called the expression rosy retrospection. It was exactly what I was looking for to describe the amnesia that sets in after you get back from a travel experience and horrible things have happened. But you just remember, you know, the man who gave you a coconut when you were so thirsty. You remember that, but you forget the dogs that attacked you when you were riding the bike. And I thought rosy retrospection was a wonderfully succinct way of summarizing that strange feeling that you get.
While we're on rosy themes, you talk about two kind of main schools in the travel writing genre in terms of the comfort or discomfort you endure. You talk about the extreme school versus the craven school, and you say that you're definitely in favor of the craven school. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, I've got to admit right from the start, I feel the odd man out here, because Thomas and Lloyd are intrepid travelers. Lloyd has been to Antarctica several times. Like, it's freezing down there. You can't swim.
I have.
Yes, I'm gone. Oh, that's even worse. Thomas has written about Colombia. They've got something called the FARC in Colombia. They're murderous bastards, you know. I wouldn't go near the place. And he's written about Brazil. I read about the HIV rates in Brazil. I even, Capture, read that the Bulgarian mafia are worse than the Sicilian mafia. So that's another destination I have to strike off my list. Now, I have been to dangerous places. I went to India once, and there was far too many people there. In my hotel, the man who cleaned the toilet lived in the toilet. The man who operated the lift lived in the lift, and I thought that was just too upsetting. I don't want to come here again. So, you know, I belong to the craven school because I only go to places where English is spoken widely, where I can drink water from the tap, where there's a cool beer within arm's reach. I've made a list of all these things. And where firearms aren't carried by the general population. I've never ridden on a camel or an elephant or a yak, and I don't intend to start now. The last guidebook I wrote was one about Auckland, which meant I didn't even have to leave Devonport to write it. But I do have adventures. It's quite wrong to think that I'm completely... It's a completely boring experience. You can have adventures in places that aren't dangerous. I climb mountains, as long as they're no higher than 100 metres. I ride a bike, as long as there are no vicious dogs in the neighbourhood. And I snorkel and swim, as long as the water's warm. I did get inside a cannibal pot on a small island in Vanuatu, and that provided me with the title for this book, and I was in the company of men whose great-grandfathers were almost certainly man-eaters. But they allowed me to get out of the pot again, and it was great fun.
Well, I must confess I am now a complete convert to the Craven School, after what you've told us. Thank you, Graham. Lloyd Spencer Davis has written a book called Looking for Darwin. It's an ambitiously conceived book that takes us on an epic journey. I would even say that it's in a kind of genre of its own, travel science, or perhaps scientific travel. It took Darwin 4 years to circumnavigate the world on that trip.
Nearly five.
Nearly five. How long did it take you to follow Darwin?
It's taken me a long time, actually, because constructing the book was a little bit like making a film. It was very unlike any other writing I've done, where when you're making a film, you're often ticking bits here and thinking, that goes there, that sort of works. And I really started the book in 2003, but it had been at the back of my mind for a while before that, so I was able to draw on some episodes from before then.
One of the great joys of the book are the moments of epiphany along the way. Darwin's moments of epiphany, yours, and the readers. From time to time you stop and observe a strange animal, sometimes a penguin, or a patch of land, and you sort of discover something quite extraordinary. What can you tell us about some of those moments of epiphany?
Well, it's a little bit like what Graham was just saying. And that was really, in part, the motivation for the travel, was that I was never sure what those moments were going to be ahead of time, but you just know by going and putting yourself in the circumstances, you'll somehow absorb something about the place. And in my case, what I was trying to do was go and absorb something about the place that gave me an insight into Charles Darwin and his ideas about natural selection and evolution. And one of the sort of great moments for me in terms of insight, because I'm a biologist, I know all about Darwin, I have all the sort of standard education and so forth, but I was in the Antarctic, as Graham alluded to, and I work on these little jobs, the little black and white penguins known as the daily penguins. But where I was at this particular moment, an emperor penguin, probably many of you have seen the film March of the Penguins. So that's the species, the largest penguins of all. Very elegant, very beautiful, very slow moving. They sort of move to you like they're in slow motion. And I was out in this area and it was really wild and I was being quite stupid because I was standing beneath a big ice cliff on an ice floe that could have been blown out to sea. And I was breaking all the rules that I had set in place as the expedition leader. And at the same time, this animal, this creature came towards me. And it was then that this moment, if you like, of realizing that this thing was so adapted to this environment that I couldn't hope to exist in for more than a few seconds if I'd taken my clothes off. It was just so at home. And yet, I was enough of a biologist to realize that it was essentially the same as the sparrow I'd left behind in my garden in Dunedin. And you think, people that can believe in the idea of the hand of God behind all this, why, when you were designing an animal that was so patently adapted for the Antarctic, would you use as a blueprint something like a sparrow in Dunedin? And that didn't make sense. So that was sort of one of those sort of insightful moments that you got by being in the environment.
Another reason why it's such an exciting travel book is that it's not, you don't approach this epic journey just from a scientific point of view, but also from a kind of humanistic point of view, so that you do things like go on the Incas Trail, you visit the Jesuit missions in Paraguay, things which are seemingly unrelated to science, which are entirely sort of civilizational, if you like. What was the most sort of striking or surprising place you visited in human terms, not in penguin terms?
Well, I think you're probably right in mentioning the Inca Trail, because I think that, and it seems like a strange place to go if you're on a quest to follow in Darwin's footsteps, because he never went near the Inca Trail. But I was taken with the notion that really south, because as you alluded to, Darwin spent nearly 5 years traveling the world, but he spent most of that time in South America. And so much of the fodder for his ideas of natural selection came from South America. And yet at the same time, that continent has been virtually taken over by Catholicism and a belief in God and so forth. So I was interested in that sort of apparent contradiction or dichotomy. And I started to think, well, what was there before God and before the Catholics? And I started thinking about the Incas, and that was what made me go and take this journey with my wife up to Machu Picchu and walk the Inca Trail. And through that process, again, it's that sort of going there and absorbing information. And part of it was getting an insight into the Incas and just how brutal the Spanish and the Catholics had been to the Incas. And I think that was really a revelation. I think I ended that part by saying, well, you know, nature may be red in tooth and claw, but, you know, if this is what religion is, then give me nature, sort of thing.
Was it really a question that you needed to answer for yourself? You know, the faith versus science? Or was it just a clever polemical device to win the reader onto the only possible enlightened side, the side of science?
That's a good question, because I started out life very much brought up in a very Christian household. Well, I say Christian household. I don't think my father even knew how to spell God, let alone how to find him. But my mother was very, very religious. And as a consequence, you know, I used to go to church, I think, four times a week or something. And then I became a biologist when I sort of needed to find something else. And in that, I became a sort of rabid Darwinist. But as you get into zoology, you realize that not everything in science is, you know, black and white like a penguin. It's a fundamental question that I think we all ask ourselves, you know, what's it all about? And if you're putting the cards on the table, then you've always got to have the question of creation and God there, I think, as one of the alternatives. So, yes, it was partly a device, but it was a genuine question, a genuine need on my part to find the answer to that question.
So who wins at the end, Darwin or God?
I don't like giving away the end of books, but but in a sense, Darwin does. I mean, the evidence is very clear. But at the same time, I think I make the point that in a sense, it doesn't really matter, because it doesn't really matter whether you think it was the hand of God or this sort of incredible journey through time, or through evolution, from sort of silly apes to humans. It doesn't really matter how we got here. The point is that we're buggering up the planet at the moment, and that's probably a more important question to be asking what we do about that than where did we come from. It's more important perhaps to ask where are we going to.
Thank you. Thomas Constam hails from Seattle and is the author of numerous Lonely Planet and Rough Guides, with a specialty in South America. You might have heard his name in the media lately, thanks to his first book, whose title you don't forget in a hurry. Do Travel Writers Go to Hell? A swashbuckling tale of high adventures, questionable ethics, and professional hedonism. It's a book which dispels the romantic myth of the travel writer's life, and the dirty laundry of the trade hangs out for all to inspect in that book. The sordid hotels, the binge drinking, the one-night stands, the confusion, the loneliness, the lack of cash, it's all there. And one critic said of Constam's book that it's the first book to blow the whistle on the travel industry's dirty little secret. Thomas, I take it you won't be doing any more guides for the Lonely Planet?
Not any time in the near future, no.
You're through with them and they're through with you?
Well, I hadn't actually worked for them for a while. I'm retired, more or less. But there's been some effort made to, you could say, marginalize and discredit me as a rogue element, which is to be expected. But what I talk about in the book, while... let me step back one second. A lot of this whole media controversy actually happened before the book came out. And there was a lot of hyperbole and speculation about what was said or wasn't said in the book. And I think that the book itself is not as scathing and is not as people had assumed. And it's not some sort of journalistic takedown on Lonely Planet. But I do speak truth through my experience to the realities of contemporary guidebook writing. And there are definitely some things that some of the powers that be don't like hearing. You know?
You do say in the introduction that this is not supposed to be an exposé, and it isn't intended to discourage the purchase or use of travel guidebooks. But of course it is, and it does. And that's the whole point of the book.
No, but I disagree with that. I still support the use of travel guidebooks. Whenever I travel, I take a guidebook and I use a guidebook. But a guidebook is a loose tool. A guidebook, over the years, became this thing, people referring to guidebooks as the Bible. And using guidebooks as this paint-by-the-numbers approach to travel, going from recommended hostel to recommended hostel. And that's just wrong on many levels. One, that the writer is running around seeing 20 restaurants a day, maybe 7 of those are making it into the guidebook, and maybe there are 50 restaurants in the town that person hasn't even visited. And you go halfway across the world, and you're sitting in the restaurant and look around, and every table has the same guidebook on it, and the people have all found their way there. Meanwhile, the place 2 doors down may be just as good or better, but just due to time constraints and physical exhaustion, maybe the writer never had a chance to set foot in there. So it's not the singular or correct way to travel, but it is a useful tool.
What, in your view, would make it possible to write a guide which is properly researched? Simply paying the author more?
Well, it's a difficult situation. There are certain inherent flaws of the paper guidebook at this point. Things are going to change as the conversion continues to online information. I think, honestly, that having a setup with royalties would, because what's happening now frequently is that a author has to invest their own money in doing the research, and you go in the hole on a number of projects that you, and some people just end up quitting after 1 or 2 books, and then there's a massive pool of young, wide-eyed writers who are willing to take the job for a byline and just do it for the pure love of travel writing, but that doesn't pay the bills, and within a couple of projects they end up quitting and are replaced by somebody else, so there's a massive amount of turnover. But I think that people would be able to make more of a sustainable career out of it if they did, in fact, receive royalties on the books. Now, that was how it was before, but considering that 99.9% of guidebooks at this point are updates on existing material, it would be an administrative nightmare to actually offer royalty. You know, who gets what percentage royalty and how many people have you had working overtime? So there isn't really a clear answer on that, unfortunately. And we'll see as technology changes how travel information like that is provided to people. It's definitely changing now, and it's going to change considerably more as we have global, you know, flat rate wireless access, things like that, into handheld devices. That's definitely going to change, and there's a lot more information being provided by locals now, whether through the blogs or printing pamphlet magazines that are handed out. I was in Patagonia not that long ago, and so a number of different towns or in the hostels, you'd find these little magazines that had been written by locals that had information way better than any guidebook writer who's passing through that town for 4 days, and you know, then the book doesn't come out for another year and a half. You just can't compete with that sort of localized information.
Do you write online travel content now?
I have. At this point, I'm not doing any, but yeah.
Are you doing any travel writing at the moment?
I'm doing some more sort of gonzo style stuff right now. I'm working on an article for when I get back about just being a travel writer, and I have something lined up about the whole concept of press trips but right now I'm After things sort of calm down with this book, I'm hoping to get back to writing a book which is a follow-up to this and about returning to civilian life after a number of years on the road and trying to reintroduce myself to a normal life, normal domestic lifestyle.
For the average punter, travel itself, you know, is the big dream. You know, going on holiday is the big dream. But for you, travel or being part of the travel industry has been a disillusion. What is your dream?
What is my dream? I don't really know what my dream is anymore. I think in the book there it follows something that I touched on a minute ago about being very wide-eyed about, okay, I'm going to kick the routine to the curb and it's going to be this fantastic job and everything. And I think that the book really, fundamentally, I was looking at just the trade-offs in life and that you may get rid of this routine and certain things that you dislike about that lifestyle, but you're giving up financial stability and normalcy and certain peacefulness in your life. For everything is a trade-off, and travel writing is a job, and frequently an extremely hard job, and there's a lot of routine to that also. So there are no answers. There's nothing that's perfect. There are only relative positives and negatives.
The big ethical question at the heart of your book, for me, is it ethical to travel? Are we as travel writers and are we as travelers simply contributing to creating a kind of monster of global tourism?
I think that we'll see movements in the next years. We'll see low-tech travel of, you know, not as more and more people are taking their phones and text messaging and, you know, laptops, and you'll see people that are trying to get away from carrying any type of technology with them. And there already is an increasing amount of, going back to Graham's comments about the American theoretical approach to travel, I'm a product actually of one of those programs. I did a master's degree where we were looking at all sorts of theory of travel and environmentally sustainable development and travel and how could, you know, how that can play a role. And that's going to increase. But at the same time, the world is shrinking at such a rate that, with Facebook and stuff, people are getting in touch with you from different countries all the time. And it's just getting closer and closer. And I don't think there's no turning back the clock at this point.
Lloyd?
The same sort of argument applies to tourism in the Antarctic. And I'm a big proponent of tourism in the Antarctic because I think people go to the Antarctic and they become ambassadors for the place. And I think the same is true of travel. I know we've got to worry now about the carbon footprint and so forth. But that aside, apart from the sort of impact on the climate, I think going to other places, going to other cultures, experiencing them is a way of developing harmony in the world and understanding, and I think I'm all for that.
Graham?
Yeah, theoretically that's true, but I've seen appalling cases of people who go to countries not the slightest bit interested in finding out about the locals. All they want to do is make a lot of noise and smash glasses around the swimming pool and things like that. And that's the sickening, that truly sickening side of mass tourism is dreadful. And then you take one island I know very well, Rarotonga. It has a permanent population of 9,000 people. It's now getting 72,000 tourists a year. Of course, they're spread out over the whole year, so you don't see them all at the same time. But it must put an enormous stress on the infrastructure. And it's a very fragile environment. How do they process the sewage from all the hotels and so on? You know, it's a real dilemma. And yet, that's all they've got is tourism. That's the only way they can make a living. And, you know, I'm in two minds about sending people down to Antarctica on cruise ships. You know, just one disaster with a ship could contaminate that environment very, very badly.
Yeah, but what's the alternative to lock everything away? I actually think that there's good tourism and bad tourism, and what we should be promoting are good practices, so that when you send tourists down to the Antarctic, they have to operate within certain protocols. Now, I don't know how that relates to Rarotonga, what you can put in place to encourage the right kind of sympathetic tourism, but I'm sure there are things that we can do that sort of thing. So, as I say, I'm all for it.
There's definitely a difference between cultural tourism and environmental tourism. There are different aspects that come into play there. And I can see with Antarctica where there's no population to that is, you know, whatever word you want to use, corrupted or changed. It's a slightly different situation, particularly on islands. The impact is even more clear.
I am Kapka Kasabova, and with me are travel writers Graham Lay, Lloyd Spencer Davis, and Thomas Konstam. I want to talk about disasters in travel tales. Graham, some of the funniest moments in your book are, you know, when your car breaks down, when you go biking and you're attacked by rabid dogs. I mean...
Rosy retrospection.
Yeah. Thomas, your book is one big account of a
disaster. Well, there was no rosy retrospection whatsoever when I came back from Rurutu, which is an island which not many people have been to, and if you're thinking of going there, forget it. The people in Tahiti who knew I was interested in the Australian islands said to me once, a few years ago, would you like to go to Rurutu? I said, yeah, sure. Yeah, I will send you there for 5 days and write a story about it. There was one hotel. I must say, coming into land, it just looked as beautiful as any other island in Polynesia. It was wonderful. You know, the fringing reef and the mountains and the lagoon. I thought, this is great. I stayed in, I think, probably the worst hotel in the whole world. It was run by a Frenchman and his Tahitian wife. The place, well, the swimming pool was like malaria breeding ground. It was all green and with mosquitoes all over it. There was no beach, it was just rubble. And when any item of furniture broke, Monsieur le Directeur would take the furniture down and throw it onto the beach. There were several couples staying there who looked just about as miserable as I felt. I mean, it was absolutely terrible. The man and his wife, they were the Basil and Sybil Fawlty of Polynesia. And when I complained, he claimed he didn't speak English, which was crap, I knew spoke English. One of the reasons I went there was because they said whales would be going past the island at that time of the year. So I said to Monsieur, where do you watch the whales from? He said, the whales have gone. And I said, where have they gone? He said, where'd the whales go? I don't know. Two dogs that belonged to the hotel adopted me. You know, I hate dogs, but they just wouldn't leave me alone. And everywhere I went, walking up and down the so-called beach, the dogs followed me, and they had horrible wounds all over them. They were disgusting. And when I tried to get away from the hotel on a bike, the dogs followed me. I realized where the wounds came from, because they were attacked by the dogs in the next patch just up the road, and a dog fight ensued, and I got caught in the middle of it. Now, all this was dreadful. I walked up
one end. But it makes a great story.
Well, it wasn't so good at the time, Captain. I walked up one, and some Rastafarians threw stones at me when I wanted to get away. So it's like being under house arrest. But it was a great opportunity for me to write, because I sat on the beach surrounded by broken furniture, and I wrote a report on the hotel for the tourist authorities back in Papeete. And I had a French dictionary with I wrote in French. It was a laborious job, but it gave me something to do, and it made me feel better. And when I went back to Tahiti for Papeete, I gave it to the director of tourism. She said, this is terrible. Well, she flew down there the next day and closed the hotel down. And it was the strangest writing experience I've ever had, writing a critique of a hotel. It was, there was nothing that I could write about that island that was possibly positive.
But that's my point. Disaster stories like this always make their way into a travel account. I mean, Thomas, your entire book is really the account of one major sort of travel catastrophe where you know. And that's why it's such fun to read. Can you imagine ever writing a travel account where everything goes according to plan?
But see, I think that the great majority of travel writing is actually positive, very earnest, very nice, fluffy stuff. And only in books do you really have the opportunity to get in. You can talk about it a little bit in a shorter article, but in the book format, you can really say what you think about a place. But in guidebooks or in most magazine writing, you know, especially in magazine writing, if you're pissing off the advertisers, it ain't going to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I in Venezuela was hit in the head with a gun and had my shoes stolen and my belt stolen, my chapstick, they tried to steal my pants. And I thought, this is the most horrible thing that's ever happened to me. And then the story made its way around, and I ended up being interviewed about it for the New York Times, and it was a big stepping stone in my career as a travel writer. It was just Not the most expected outcome from, but you know, stories of hardship are good.
An appalling coda to the Rarotu experience was a few months later, I read in the New Zealand Herald travel pages of a man who had been sent by the Herald to Rarotu, and he extolled it. He said, the people are so nice and the environment is so unspoiled. He didn't mention the hotel. I can't have stayed in that hotel. He must have stayed in a guest house. And I thought, is this the same island that I went to? And it comes back to Thomas's point. A lot of these stories are just puff, you know. They're flattering because the people who are writing them know that if they write anything critical, there's no way they're going to be asked back again. You know, and the travel editor of one of New Zealand's major dailies went to Myanmar a couple of years ago as a guest of the Burmese government and came back saying, what a wonderful country. Hey, what's he thinking now? I hope he's got a conscience. You know, he's thinking, why didn't I say something truthful, you know? So I think that distinction between writing a book and writing a magazine or a newspaper piece is a very, very important one to draw.
Thomas, have you been cured of your addiction to traveling?
Well, actually, sitting down to write a book clipped my wings for a bit. Well, that and being very broke. So I had about a year and a half there where I did pretty minimum travel, but I'm obviously here. I'm starting to get out again. I'm hoping to. I have a few trips planned for later in the year.
Hardcore trips or the Craven School type of trips?
Well, actually, I wanted to say something about the Craven School. Both Colombia and Brazil have lots of beaches and palm trees and many, many beers. That's not hard to come by. Yeah. They do have lots of
gangster
firearms though. Yeah. But as an American, we're not so shocked by firearms.
It does raise the point, though, if as travel writers, whether we're doing the world a favour by writing about places and have people read what you write and be enticed to those places, and therefore making a carbon footprint, you know, like a Bigfoot, or whether we're doing, looking at it another way, we write about places so people don't actually have to go there. They can experience it vicariously. I mean, I always wanted to go to Machu Picchu. Uh-huh. Until I read Lloyd's description of getting there. And I thought, you know, I mean, there's wonderful descriptions of the booking system. You have to book to get there, and you had to sort of jump the queue to get there. And then, you know, on top of that, there's all this corruption. You know, forget it. I've read about it. I know what an awful experience. I'm sure it's wonderful when you get there, but the getting there just didn't make it. So, okay, there's one person who has stayed at home rather than go to Machu Picchu.
Well, maybe I am an effective writer then.
You certainly were in that case.
I'd like to open up for questions from you now.
My question is to Thomas. When I read about your book and your attack on Lonely Planet and other travel guides, I guess, I haven't read the book yet, but I immediately looked at quite a few travel guides that I had and noticed that, in fact, most of them were written by people who were actually living in those countries. So I just wondered how common is it for people like yourself to be actually going to a country that not resident in and writing a travel guide?
The great, great majority of English language guidebooks are written by Americans, Brits, Australians, a few Kiwis, and Canadians for the whole world over. And it's, I think, that's changing some. There's starting to be some more people in country, and when they can contract an expat who lives in country, that's good. But I think there are very few local writers overall writing for guidebooks. Maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't seen it that much.
Sounds like you guys do a lot of traveling maybe by yourself. Does that must make the kind of experience a bit different, you know, like having to kind of go out and engage or have things happen to you?
I talk about it some in my book, when you're doing that all the time, particularly as your job, waking up in rooms and looking at the ceiling and not really knowing where you are, and there's certain downside to that, almost a depression that comes on sometimes, particularly in the mornings, I felt, where, you know, what am I doing, and am I the sort of the consummate outsider in everything that I'm doing here? But also forces you out of the comfort zone. It forces you to introduce yourself to other people, and it's a very different experience. Plus, there's no expectation from anyone else involved, so you can, if you just feel like blowing off the afternoon and walking around, and you get totally lost four times, no, you know, so what?
Yeah, if I could add to that, I much prefer traveling with someone, just because there's something about sharing the experience. But things happen to you more often if you're by yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because you're forced out of that comfort zone. So the times I've been robbed, they've all been times when I've been by myself.
I'm sure your wife appreciates that.
Yeah.
Must be something wrong with me. I've never been robbed. But it's probably because I go to safe places. But there's such a thing in the trade, I'm sure these academics in America, it's called the free and independent traveler. And these are people who don't go with a group, you know. And that's the way I mostly do it. And I must say, it is better for a writer to do it that way. I've been on journalistic trips with journalists. They're pretty terrible, you know, because a lot of them, it's just a junket, you know. It's a perk of the office. They say, oh, she hasn't been to, you know, Vanuatu for a few years. Let's send her. So they get a team of people together, and you end up with these people you don't really want to be with, and it's not a good experience, mostly. So I prefer to go by myself. And it's easier to strike up conversations with interesting people. You get off the beaten track a bit. I can ride my bike and you know, without going in with a party. That's how I like to do it.
Graham, you say that you're a craven traveller, but you ended up in India, which I think everyone sort of knows more or less what India's like without going there. So why did you choose to go there?
Well, I was young and curious, and I was, you know, breaking away from New Zealand, and I thought, well, India, you know, looks interesting, you know, a bit red, Rudyard Kipling. But, you know, I couldn't wait to get out of the place. I just thought, this is not for me. I made the mistake of going in the summer, and Delhi's probably about 42 degrees in their summer, and no, it didn't do much for me. I just hunkered down in my hotel and listened to bad Indian music most of the time.
Actually, that sounds very like a chap that I met at the Delhi airport. I was in line, and he was a big American. Sorry about this, but he was a big, strapping American.
And he just, Americans all you want.
Yeah, well, he was saying this is just the worst place he's ever been to in his goddamn life. And because I was the only sort of Pakeha fellow there, he felt that I must feel some sympathy with his views. And I tried to escape. And I went into the waiting area, and as they called the aircraft, he saw me, and he shouted across the whole terminal, "Happiest moment of my life." So I slunk under the chair. Yeah.
But there are some people, you know, who go to India and love it. They walk around in loincloths and things and become instant vegetarians. You know, I mean, it's because I'm a coward, you know. Just.
Another question?
Thomas, I was quite interested in what you were talking about just then, about being an American travelling. Like, what's the response that you get from people? Because, you know, we generally say when I've travelled and I've met Americans, it's like, oh, you left, you know? And, you know, what locals' sort of attitudes towards you are like?
Well, I think, and I say in the book, you know, that I don't harbour anything about other American travelers, that I've met some embarrassing assholes from pretty much every country out there on the planet. I think one of the issues with the U.S. is that it's such a big country and we have so much variety within the country. A lot of people think, oh, well, if I want to go to the beaches, I'll just go to Florida. And we do, I want to go to the mountains, I'll go to Colorado. And it traditionally has just seemed easier for people to stay inside of the country. Until recently we had something like, you know, less than 20% of the country had passports, which is pathetic, but at the same time we have over 300 million people now, so it's still a significant number of travelers. Obviously, since 2000 and with the current administration that we have, I think people have had a lot more of a negative take on the U.S. But people tend to judge you as a person once, you know, and not on your nationality once you get past the first 2 minutes of conversation. So
obviously we've all done a lot of traveling, so I'm just wondering, like, this isn't really saying, like, do you ever lose the itch to travel, but more, does it ever lose some of its magic? Like, once you've seen one beautiful mountain, like, what's the need to go see another one?
Not like that. The burnout that I've suffered as a traveler is covering a lot of ground in a single trip. I feel more attracted to going one place and staying. Right now, if I were to take a trip, I'd be more attracted to renting an apartment for a length of time in a city, or going into a small town and just staying there rather than doing an overland voyage. But no, I don't think that the world ever ceases to, you know, if it's really in your blood, it's always going to be.
Graham?
Yeah, I think once a traveler, you're always a traveler, you know, and even if you've just had a rerouted experience, you come home again, after a while, you know, you read a book, you read, you know, Lloyd's book, or Thomas's book, or some other really good travel writer, and you think, yeah, I'd love to go there. And you start working towards it. So rosy retrospection sets in, and, you know, the horizons look tempting again. I think, you know, a lot of Kiwis are like that. We're incurable travelers.
Lloyd?
Oh, I'm definitely in the same school. I never lose the thrill of travel, and I just get so excited going to a new place, and particularly where I see new environments and new people, new animals, and so forth. And that rosy reflection, it really does work. I mean, I wish it worked on my golf game the same way, because, you know, it's not enough for me to get out and play golf thinking about the other 160 shots I've done. But I always want to go back traveling, even if we've had bad experiences.
This is a perfect note to end on. Graham Lay, Lloyd Spencer-Davis, Thomas Constam, thank you very much.